Hello.
Hi, my name is Rajiv Khurana. I'm from ACLU Ohio. I'm a policy analyst and research intern there, and I'm here to talk to you today about the USA Patriot Act, anti-terrorism legislation, and how that implicates information technology, small to medium-sized businesses, and your civil liberties. When we look back at the 1990s, we think of the information age and how it first started and all these great lofty ideals of free flow of information. We think of ideas being exchanged to no end and the free communication between people all across the globe without interference from the government or censors or things like that. But September 11th, 2001 dramatically changed those issues. Instead, today we live in a society where the government has the potential to tap all your electronic communications, subpoena your businesses, computer hardware, electronic information, records, without you ever knowing. 6 weeks after September 11th, Congress passed the USA Patriot Act, passed virtually with little debate, much less scrutiny. The Patriot Act has two profound implications for what I'm here to talk to you about today. The first is its implication on telecommunications and businesses. For those of us that work for small businesses or even frequent them, the USA Patriot Act has redefined the entire way these businesses operate and function and the way we interact with them. Things like banks, credit unions, thrift stores, pawn shops, car dealers, real estate brokers, currency exchanges, and jewelers are now considered financial institutions under the Patriot Act, though they probably have very little to do with our traditional concept of financial institution. What this means is that the government all of a sudden forces these businesses to comply with anti-money laundering solutions, which means that they have to develop policies to deter money laundering, hire internal compliance officers, train employees, and conduct numerous audits. What does this matter? It matters for us in the job market. First, it means that all these regulations now impose higher costs on small businesses, makes it much more difficult for them to turn a profit because more of their money is going over to things like anti-terrorism compliance, when car dealerships and pawn shops probably have very little to do with it. Small firms like single branch pawn shops, currency exchanges can expect to spend at least $10,000 to $15,000 just to become in compliance with the technical regulations. Small banks, up to $1 million just for the software, 10% to 15% more to hire the consultants to set it up and integrate it with previously existing machinery and technology. But for all the effort and all the red tape that we've introduced into the small business world and introduced into our lives, it probably has very little to do with terrorism. Most of the terrorists, specifically Mohammed Atta, who the government has defined as the chief terrorist, the mastermind behind September 11th, had a perfectly legal bank account at SunTrust in Phoenix. This legislation would probably do little for that. More troubling, however, is the fact that smaller banks may begin to worry even more. They may begin to wonder if this person who's opening an account is a little bit suspicious. Maybe there's something wrong with them, adding more fuel to the fire, so to say, sending our limited resources in all sorts of directions with little or no guidance, making true terrorists harder to find. The next implication is that on the telecommunications industry. There are two portions of the Patriot Act that specifically deal with telecommunications. There's Section 215 and Section 216 out of nearly 1,000 different sections and 1,200 pages. Section 215 of the Patriot Act extends the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978, otherwise known as FISA, to things like internet service providers, phone companies, and other small businesses. What this means is that when these industries are now subpoenaed, they're forced to turn over computer servers, technical equipment, books, paper records, documents, at the discretion of the FBI. This has three specific implications. The first is that an individual being investigated doesn't have to be a foreign national. You can be born, bred, and raised in the United States of America and still be under surveillance under a law that's titled the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, just as an American citizen, because they suspect that you might be working for a foreign government or somebody that's working against the government. Second, is that the people who are being spied upon, so to say, are never informed. If the FBI has a warrant to tap your network, you'll never know. If the FBI has decided to call Amazon and ask what books you've bought and see Amazon's computer hardware, where the books you bought, where the orders were placed, you'd never know. There's no way to challenge these warrants. Third is that while we always talk about warrants and how there's some sort of probable cause and that famous statement, you can't search without probable cause, not under the Patriot Act. These warrants and your surveillance can all be done by the government without any sort of judicial review. The FBI simply fills out some paperwork and a judge signs off on it. There's no hearing to contest it. The business can't tell you you're being surveilled, and the government surely is not going to bother to tell you. Yeah?
Does that need to be any federal judge, or does it need to be a member of the FISA court?
For this specific section, it needs to be a member of the FISA court. But under other provisions, it's just an administrative order that a judge will sign off upon.
Mm-hmm. You imply that there was no judicial review and that there is no probable cause needed, but it still has to be signed off by a judge.
Right. It's an administrative hearing in that it basically makes sure they cross the T's and dot the I's. There's no way that you can contest this hearing. Yeah, normal warrants, because the warrant has to be presented to you, that you can call your lawyer and seek to contest the warrant. But in this case, you don't know that you're being watched. Second is that the FISA court isn't open to the public. The second section is Section 216, which is even more troubling. In the 1980s and even the 70s, we had things called pen registers. Pen registers were plugged into phone systems that basically recorded what numbers were dialed out of a certain location and how long the call duration was for. Section 216 expands the pen register statute to packet sniffers. What this means is that without a warrant, without your knowledge, the government can decide that they need to place a packet sniffer on your phone company, your telecommunications provider's network. This basically allows them to intercept all the data that comes across the network. The FBI says that the packet sniffer they use will only record the URLs you've asked for, the email addresses you've sent to, and the files you've requested. But the fact that the FBI is the one installing the packet sniffers and is the one designing the packet sniffers with little to no public scrutiny makes us kind of skeptical. Again, with this statute, there's no probable cause standard here for for them to be able to place a packet sniffer to detect where your communications are going and who they're taking place with. It'll listen to all bits of information crossing its path, including content and identification. And basically, we have no idea how often it's used. The FBI and Department of Justice are supposed to report to Congress biannually as to how often it's used. However, each time since the enactment of the Patriot Act, they've said zero, or they've refused to disclose that information publicly. Main concern with us here at the ACLU is that there's just too much government discretion. We see the government being able to do things without the public knowing, without its citizens knowing, and we're left to wonder what's going on. What's the society we live in? We created all of these technologies, and we've worked to improve our democracy into one where information flows freely, or one where we can discuss things without worrying about who's watching our back, who's deciding whether or not we might be terrorists, who's deciding whether or not our protests might be too violent. Section 216 is also troubling because now federal courts in New York can order a sort of wiretap, this pen register and packet sniffer, on somebody in San Jose, California. Any federal court has jurisdiction across the entire country to implement Section 216 searches. So if you work or you own a business in San Jose, and the Department of Justice and the FBI have decided to file for a warrant in New York, it means your business now has to float a bunch of lawyers into New York City, prepare them for a New York District Court, and get them back to San Jose, meet with them, and absorb all those costs, making these warrants virtually unchallengeable as well. Now, while a lot of these things are going on, there are still things we can do. The first is that a lot of these provisions in the Patriot Act are set to expire at the end of 2005. But the Bush administration has been deciding and pushing for their renewal and to make them permanent. As citizens, we can do a couple things. First, we need to inform others. A lot of small business owners, when I go out to talk to them, they're completely unaware that their currency exchange, their gas station, their used car dealership, their pawn shop are now covered under anti-terrorism legislation. Second is we need to get out and vote. No matter what political party you're affiliated with, no matter who you think should win the presidential election, we need to get out there and make sure that everybody's voice is heard. Because without that, we're not a democracy. We're governed by a minority of people. And if our democracy decides that these are what we want, that's fine. But at least we should all be heard. The next thing you can do is write your congressperson. Because the debate over the renewal of the Patriot Act is heating up in Congress, with the Bush administration looking to push this legislation before the end of its term. And if you think that these are issues that might bother you, you can always write your congressperson. The next thing is you can join the ACLU. We have a large litigation campaign set up across the country. We're the first organization who's legally challenged portions of the Patriot Act and is currently in this certain provisions hearings are taking place in the Supreme Court. Does anybody have any questions?
Do you get the sense that the provisions that apply to small businesses, the money laundering provisions, do you get the sense that that's more intended to try and broaden the information net that the government is receiving data from, or do you get the sense that it's more an extra piece of flypaper where if they want to nail a business, they've got this extra charge they can tack on them?
It's interesting you say that. When the Patriot Act was initially designed, the editorials that came out about it, the congresspeople that came out and really rallied their support talked about it being the great stepping stone in fighting terrorism, the great tools we need to stop terrorists from attacking our country again. Since then, we've seen Western Union being fined $8 million because they weren't in compliance. We've seen drug busts that have been done using the legislation and the tools through the Patriot Act. We've seen student marches and organizations infiltrated under various provisions within the Patriot Act. So it's a little bit of both. It's that they're businesses that are getting nailed. The Professional Diving Association in May of 2002 the FBI requested all of their records for all the divers that have been trained within the last 5 years. This came about because someplace in the Florida Keys, FBI agents decided to show up to all the local dive shops and ask for their records. Dive shops said, we don't keep records. I mean, we're a dive shop. Some of them had privacy policies, those that did keep records. And as members of the Professional Divers Association, they decided, well, we should call our association. The association agreed to turn over 6 zip disks worth of personal data regarding its members, its clients, anybody who's associated with the Professional Divers Association. To date, the Divers Association is facing several lawsuits because the Patriot Act doesn't protect people from voluntarily turning over information. But the Divers Association was between a rock and a hard place. Its members were like, you know, we pay our dues, it's your job to protect us and sort these things out. The government was like, well, we want the information, and if not, you're going to have some trouble. So they turned it over, but in the end, it wasn't a great move for them legally because they weren't on the right side of the law. Airlines are also facing several lawsuits, JetBlue most notably, because JetBlue decided that voluntarily they would turn over the information rather than have to deal with the government coming in, picking up the computers, copying all the data and whatnot. So they turned over the information a couple months ago. JetBlue is also being sued by several organizations and several people whose information has been turned over. Now, while we don't really know, you know, that we can cite this, this, and this, that they've prevented terrorism, we do know that a lot of people are getting really upset, and a lot of people are unknowingly being surveilled and unknowingly being watched. And that's where we stand on that. Anybody else?
I'd heard some information that some of the provisions in Patriot 2 have been pushed into other bills. What is the status of that? What from Patriot 2 has been passed? What hasn't been passed?
Patriot 2 is an interesting story. It's a story that the ACLU likes to talk about because right when Patriot 2 was beginning to be pushed by the Bush administration and John Ashcroft, the expansion of the Patriot Act to even more places within our daily lives, we began to mobilize a lot of support. People said that the first time was enough and we're not going any further. So the Patriot 2 legislation itself has been broken down. It's pretty much been abandoned by the Bush administration. There are certain provisions that have made their way into various appropriations bills as riders and things like that, but there's nothing significant that's been added to the Patriot Act. There's always talk about different ways to interpret it, but we can't really say that certain provisions have made it in and we can talk about those, because really the Bush administration has had a lot of difficulty in pushing more Patriot-like legislation. There's a coalition of Republicans called Republicans for Civil Liberties, I believe, and it's about 50 to 60 House members that have come out against the Patriot Act, against the Bush administration. We see people from all over the country, from Alaska to Arizona, from every political party coming out against the Patriot Act. The September 11th hearings are a really interesting case because I was listening to that also, and that same morning Janet Reno testified. Janet Reno's argument was there were no walls, we just weren't looking for it. It's not something we were prepared for. Nobody thought about it. And if there were walls, they weren't very significant, because if you remember, right before the change in the millennium, there was a terrorist plot that was foiled in Seattle, right? Now, we were on guard. We were looking because we knew that there, if something was going to happen, it was going to happen then. And the fact that we successfully stopped that attack means the walls couldn't have been that big. And when we listened to the testimony of the Clinton administration, even some of the Bush administration officials that have decided to resign, they really say there wasn't much of a wall. The problem was that we specifically weren't telling people where to go. We didn't have the resources. I think it's the FBI director said that he requested 1,700 new people to come out and work in anti-terrorism in the United States. He got 76. He didn't need any new laws. He wasn't asking for a broad expansion of government powers. He was simply asking for more people. He needed more agents. He needed more translators. He got 76 out of 1,700. So law is changing the way our government functions and changing the way that we view things and the way that citizens and government interact isn't necessarily the only way to go about things. There are ways that we can do it if we just step up traditional police work, just good investigative police work. We get out, we have informants, we do things like that. We don't necessarily have to impose undue burdens on citizens. And I think at the ACLU, we recognize that terrorism is a reality, that we live in a world that isn't necessarily the safest place ever. But there are other ways to do it. We can still be safe and we can still be free. That's what we stand for. Becker?
my understanding was the whole purpose for having two agencies, the FBI and the CIA, was that they had different mandates, and that the techniques that they used for basically investigating non-citizens outside the United States and for investigating citizens inside the United States effectively were considered to be, you know, fundamentally different. What was acceptable and what wasn't. And I guess my question is this a fundamental shift in that philosophy that we treat, you know, non-citizens and citizens differently, and is that, you know, effectively that tearing down the wall between the organizations? Because there were, in my understanding, some actual limitations on sharing information because of the very nature of the distinct agendas of the two different organizations.
You're correct in that the CIA's mandate, or its stated purpose, is to do foreign intelligence. It's supposed to work entirely outside of the United States, whereas the FBI is supposed to be almost like a law enforcement agency, doing drug busts, arresting criminals that cross state lines and whatnot. Well, Section 215 blurs the line between citizen and non-citizen. Because now citizens can be taken to the foreign intelligence courts. As far as technique goes, with just basic surveillance techniques, I think that the CIA, because most of their activity goes on outside the United States, would naturally be prone to use different techniques. That they have a looser mandate because it's harder for us to conduct effective oversight. Whereas the FBI, we can watch because they're on our soil. We see agents in D.C. all the time. You know, when there's something going on around the country, we see them. And with the Patriot Act, a lot of it speaks to the FBI and expanding the role of the FBI. As far as the CIA goes, it doesn't really do much with them because, as I said, it's the Patriot Act's focus exclusively on preventing domestic terrorism within our borders. And while it may grant some of the powers that the CIA has and allow them to use some of the techniques that the CIA uses, there's still a fine line between them, and that's just the borders issue.
So I guess that's the point of the debate, for removing the oversight from the very fact that the base was built in oversight in the FBI. Is that basically what we're coming down to, is that we're removing the oversight from the internal investigative branches?
Yeah. At its most basic level, that's what it comes down to, is that watching over American citizens and watching over resident aliens and people that live here has become a whole lot easier for the federal government than before September 11th because of the Patriot Act, because administrative warrants can now travel across the country, because there's no review, because there's no probable cause standards established into a lot of the investigative tools established through the Patriot Act. Does that answer your question? The Patriot Act doesn't really deal with the NSA. I think what you're talking about is the COINTELPRO Act. That's true. The NSA, with regards to our position, is almost something it's a rather difficult issue to tackle because there's so little oversight. There's so little we know about where the money goes, who's spending it, what's it being spent on, that from our position at the ACLU, it's almost finding a needle in the haystack to find an NSA program that we can say severely limits our civil liberties. And a lot of the work we do focuses on the Patriot Act because it's so pervasive and because it's so blatant that we can mobilize our resources a lot more effectively to combat it.
Can you talk about the CALEA expansion, wherein I know they're talking about expanding CALEA to cover voice over IP providers. Now, as a software developer, what would the impact be on me developing a voice over IP software package?
From our understanding of that issue, the developer really doesn't take much of a liability. The government tends to focus, because if they focused on developers, there are numerous developers, especially with the open source movement, things like that, that it's almost impossible for them to deal with. They've gone more towards the infrastructure, that if there's voice over IP going on with things like a packet sniffer or something like that, they can take those into account. Now, what blurs the line here is that there isn't a way necessarily to interpret the laws one way or another. That there hasn't the technology is so new that government, lawyers, judges, at that point it tends to become a crapshoot almost as to which way they're going to rule. That government can't keep up with technology. I mean, that's why it's taken so long for even the most basic regulations to be placed on the internet. And we can't decide how to do it. That there are a lot of good arguments each way. And to get 535 people, or even, you know, just half of that, and the executive to agree on how to do something takes a lot of work. And even more work for them to figure out exactly what the fine print's going to be and things like that. But on the developer side, I wouldn't really worry so much. It's the people that are doing the communications that really have to worry.
Do you have any idea of encryption as far as encrypting your emails, encrypting your web traffic, versus encrypting voice over IP? Is that an effective countermeasure to them spying on you?
Well, the packet sniffer is technically only supposed to capture packets of data. It's supposed to stop there, that you can take the data, you can look at it. Now, whether or not the data is encrypted and what they do with that, really, we don't know. Like, it's not published, it's not something that they've talked about, right? Because, I mean, obviously you can send email that's encrypted. You can use an anonymizer while you're on the web. You can go, there are a lot of different ways to skirt the issue, so to speak. But it's really unclear as to where the government's going with that. Is it something they're going to turn over to the NSA to decrypt? Is it something they're going to decrypt in-house, right? Those kind of programs, I mean, they can't say they would because that would be breaking the law, because the law only allows them to capture the data and look at the data as it is. And that's that issue.
I would add to that that, you know, the fact that you're sending email to somebody named Mohammed, or the fact that you're sending encrypted email to somebody named Mohammed, they don't care. You know, what's in the headers tells them more than enough. You know, if you make a particular phone call, they don't care what the content of the phone call is. You know, if it goes to a party line that terrorists are known to hang out on, that's incriminating enough without hearing what happened on it. What you're more concerned about is the routing. You know, if all of your email goes out to some server that, you know, mixes it around and sends it out, then the routing is harder for them to interpret. If all of your phone calls, and that's much harder to obscure. You know, if you somehow had a way so that every number dialed from your phone was the same, and every incoming call to your phone was the same, then they wouldn't be able to analyze your traffic the same. It's not the content so much as the routing.
Well, that kind of goes to the whole idea where you're talking about, like, using an anonymizer. I mean, it seems like a perfect phishing tool for how many of those are potentially government run.
Okay.
I mean, because if you're looking for, you know, it's like, okay, well, if somebody's looking for anonymous, well, let's kind of see why they're
why they want to be anonymous.
And unfortunately, the question is that there are some people who just basically, you know, want to be anonymous just because they're paranoid and that helps them feel safe.
And that brings up an interesting point, is that it's always, in this situation, it's the most innocent people, the majority of the most innocent people that are always the ones being watched. Because, I mean, a lot of people just like to do things anonymously. Like, that's what the purpose of the internet is. We can sit in our computer, we can sit at a coffee shop, do whatever we want, nobody knows that we're doing it. We can go look on the web for whatever it is, and it's just us. It's you and the computer, and it's a very private, intimate experience. Whereas now, that sense of anonymity, that sense of being a face in the crowd is gone almost, because there's always the potential for somebody to be watching just because you take that extra step or because you are conscious of your privacy.
I had a question about the whole thing with how it impacts or crosses over as part of the Freedom of Information Act, what we've been able to get any records that have been gathered on you. What's the impact?
Freedom of Information Act's been a major tool for us, organizations filing lawsuits against the government, challenging the Patriot Act, the Constitutional Rights Foundation. We've all sent out a bunch of Freedom of Information Act requests. Many of them come back blank. Many of them come back with no records. The government says we don't do it. But sometimes you strike a gold mine. I recall there was a Freedom of Information Act request regarding the number of libraries that have been visited. Officially, the Bush administration says that only a handful have been visited. The University of Illinois' library program, their library college, filed a Freedom of Information Act almost a year ago. And a year ago, there were 15,000 libraries across the country that have been visited by FBI agents, 1,200 that have been subpoenaed, and a handful more that have just decided to turn over the records without any sort of, you know, what are you doing here? Any questions being asked? As in, guys in black suits show up, shake hands with the librarian, ask her how things are going. Can we see some records? The records are the books you've checked out. What books you checked out? How often you check them out? Whether or not you use the internet there? Things like that.
As in, they didn't follow the guidelines from the American Library Association.
Right. I don't think that's an issue that's really hit our radar screen, sad to say. Those kind of issues really tend to come up with the Electronic Freedom Foundation. That organization does a lot of really great work on this side. The ACLU tends, while we take a position on this, our resources tend to be diverted in so many different directions. Like Sunday, we have the March for Women's Lives, in D.C. We've got several cases pending in the Supreme Court. We've got racial profiling, airport passenger screening, those sort of things. So being sort of more of an umbrella organization, so to say, I'm sad to say almost that that sort of thing really escapes our radar, that when something like that, as potentially powerful as that is, because the technology is so new, that it's hard to keep up with. And it's more a task that EFF and those organizations tend to be better suited to because they have a greater number of technical people who can sit through and understand exactly what's going on with those issues and what those implications are on a deeper level rather than just on the surface.
Mm-hmm. Going back to the comments and questions regarding the operation between CIA, FBI, and NSA, my understanding is that a lot of the walls there were due to the fact that if the FBI received evidence or information from either the CIA or the NSA regarding a U.S. citizen, then any criminal case against them would be tainted by that.
As far as citizens go, I'm not sure whether or not how this idea of tainted works, because sure, that there are legal problems with the CIA.
It goes back to the fact that the FBI has, prior to the Patriot Act, has had to use a much higher standard. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true. That the FBI previous to the Patriot Act was held to a much higher standard. That they were subject to judicial review because their warrants were standard bench warrants. That they had to observe basic constitutional protections and protections against search and seizure established through case law. With the Patriot Act, we've seen a lot of that change in that it's become more of an administrative duty. And warrants tend to flow a lot quicker now. Whether or not it's on the level that the CIA has decided that they can watch foreign nationals in other countries and do that sort of thing, it will probably, hopefully, never be at that level. Because, like I said, with the CIA, there's very little oversight we have as American citizens to ask them exactly what they're doing and where, you know, how it's going, what kinds of provisions they're following. Because a lot of it's classified and a lot of it's done in secret.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of investment in technology that we're getting smaller and a lot of changes in society right now. And there's some real issues, obviously, that need to be addressed, changes that need to be made. I guess my question is related to that. It seems like too many other agendas are getting mixed in. And how do you separate that out? For instance, they had, I know at least once the RIA pushed through a rider on a terrorist bill where they were trying to get it passed where they could go in without notification into other people's computers to look for music that you potentially had on your computer to have downloaded, and if they basically destroyed your computer, they didn't need any evidence showing that they actually had this, they could do it without oversight, as you say. And if they destroyed your computer and your data on it, you're a small business and you're basically, your data got destroyed, you're not liable. That bill did not go through,
mm-hmm.
but it obviously had very little to do with terrorism, and unfortunately, too often, it seems like there's a lot of mixed agenda stuff going on where there are real issues. They're really trying to push through and trying to do some real things, but unfortunately, whether corporate or government, you know, political or other agendas are getting mixed in. But how do you separate that? How do you protect against
The way I understand the political process, it's very difficult to protect against that. If you look into like just general government budget appropriations, things like that, you'll see riders and amendments attached everywhere. In farm legislation, you'll see riders about pharmaceutical companies protecting them from lawsuits, things like that. Instances of political log rolling and just attaching riders tends to just be a function of policy entrepreneurs trying to find a place that they can attach their special issues. I guess as citizens, the most we can do is take notice. Our political process doesn't really have a safeguard built into that, that, you know, a piece of terrorism legislation can only deal with terrorism, that farm legislation can only deal with farms. Basically, anything can be attached to any bill and rolled through the Congress under the guise of anti-terrorism or transportation, things like that. And that's where, you know, when people talk about like pork barrel spending and things like that, that's where a lot of that comes from, is just various riders and amendments attached on to legislation. And there, since the modern politics, modern democracy in America, and political maneuvering has really come about in the 1920s and through on and evolved, that's a problem that we've always been dealing with so much. Yeah.
Except that, I agree, there's a long-known problem, but now with the level of legislation, due to the increase in, you know, shifts in society, and the increase in the amount of legislation, we have basically come in the forefront on some of these different issues that are basically affecting all new, you know, forefronts. It seems like this is becoming a, you know, much more complicated issue where it was, you know, distasteful at times. Now it seems like it's going beyond distasteful and threatening the whole infrastructure to a certain extent if it's abused too much, which it seems like it has the potential to do in the near future.
It's true that we've become a society where there's a lot more legislation, that there's a lot more rules passed, and I think it's only natural to expect that there will be more of these riders and amendments attached onto it, especially as the power of special interest groups grow, the power of corporations, the power of big business to influence influential Congress people. As that grows, we're going to see more of that. It's not, because there's no procedural safeguard established against it, there's not much technically that stands in the way of attaching numerous riders and amendments to bills that often go overlooked. There are a bunch of organizations like the ACLU that hold educational programming, give talks around the country within their communities about the Patriot Act. If you go on most candidates' websites, they'll have a portion, you know, declaring whether or not they're for or against. At least the major presidential candidates have decided, you know, where they stand on the issue. As far as an overall grassroots movement, yes. In 34 states within the country, communities have passed anti-Patriot Act resolutions. Now, while legally and technically they don't do much, they say that local law enforcement will not assist in implementing the Patriot Act or this community takes a stand against it, there is a movement to raise awareness almost. I think 22 million people live in the communities and states that have passed anti-Patriot Act resolutions. I think it's the Bill of Rights Defense Campaign that does most of that grassroots organizing. They send out like draft resolutions to people in various localities that are trying to get their city council to vote on it and pass anti-Patriot Act resolutions. We've seen cities like Los Angeles, Chicago, places in Westchester, New York, Cleveland Heights just passed one. And all across the country, we're seeing mobilization in that sort of very grassroots, let's get our city council. Like Yellow Springs has passed one. I think Oberlin is doing something with it. I'm not sure if it's been passed yet. But yeah, there is that grassroots, but it's very It's grassroots tends to be. It's very segmented, but and organization is difficult. But the fact that in 34 states there's at least one community that has gotten their leadership to stand up against the Patriot Act says something, that somebody cares out there.
Mm-hmm. How effective are those anti-Patriot Act laws? Has there actually been a case where they butt heads, and what's the outcome?
No, there hasn't been a case where, you know, let's say, like Los Angeles, which has passed one of them, Los Angeles police have butt heads with FBI agents. From what I've read, as far as like the legal analysis, they're more symbolic than anything. I mean, to be completely honest, it's a symbolic gesture more than a legal or technical change into the way that law enforcement interacts with one another.
Mm-hmm. I guess with all of this, I mean, the term terrorist seems to be thrown out kind of loosely, and I kind of wonder if there's some definitive idea of a terrorist, or is this like a moving target? One of the things kind of comes to my mind is the idea that my understanding was that during the time of war, a lot of your actual civil liberties are actually rolled back because it's considered, you know, that during a time of war, for instance, speaking against your president or the government is considered a terrorist act. Well, this was a fundamental protected right during normal peacetime to be able to have a dissenting opinion during wartime. It is not. And while it hasn't been enforced, technically, Bush, my understanding also was that Bush actually made a formal "We are at war" declaration that the word is, that they were showing us on a different program. We were actually analyzing this after he made that speech back a couple years ago, that was an official declaration of war, which had specific constitutional implications, which rolled back a lot of the civil liberties that we were used to. And the fact that he said this is an unending war, or, you know, a war without, you know, like, you know, it's going to be long term, et cetera, et cetera. That basically that those civil liberties were in effect rolled back for an extended period of time. But the whole point of rolling back civil liberties in the past, theoretically, was that during time of war, was that it was a short-term thing, that you go to war, you have it lasts for a couple of years, and then you go on with life. And during the time of crisis of war, you know, it was the idea of rolling back civil liberties for that short period of time was tenable, that was acceptable. Mm-hmm. In order to get through a time of crisis. Well, this effectively has now become an open-ended rollback on basic constitutional rights. And if you incorporate that with the whole idea of what now becomes a terrorist, I guess I'm wondering where all of this really...
During World War II, there were several thousand Japanese citizens, American citizens, who happened to be of Japanese descent. They were born in America, they worked for American companies. They were your typical American dream. 2.5 kids, owned a small business, that sort of thing. They were interned on the West Coast. They were locked up, thrown into basically detention centers, and kept there for years. They were forced to sell their businesses, sell their homes. They can only take a very limited number of possessions with them. The idea of war and, you know, justifying rolling back our civil liberties is dangerous. Because we can see things like that happen now. Like, what's to stop them from interning Arab Americans, people that don't necessarily look like they're American? The idea that we still live in a society that we're judging people based on their skin color, not even their nationality, not whose passport they hold, not where they're born, but the fact that they don't look like the majority of the country, to me at least, is threatening. That we can, if the president comes up and says we're at war with Iraq, we're at war with terrorism, I think for him to say that, just to say that we're at war, doesn't grant him the power to limit our constitutional rights, because there hasn't been a formal declaration of war by Congress.
But that's what I'm saying. Right. Supposedly, that his actual declaration was judged by, they brought on constitutional lawyers under CNN and some of the other news organizations, and said that effectively this was a declaration of war.
Right. The, But the War Powers Act limits the president's ability to just outright declare war. I think it's 90 days or so that he can declare war without congressional approval and a congressional sign-off that, yes, we are in war. That's why you'll notice that technically it's a conflict in Iraq, that it's a liberation program. That the language doesn't say war, but the legislation that was passed after Vietnam and whatnot is really explicit in that it has to say that the president can only declare war for 90 days. He can declare a conflict for as long as he wants. Now, how that plays into the constitutional issues can be tenuous in that it becomes a game of semantics, right? Like conflict, war, liberation, occupation, you know, all these things tend to thrown around, and depending on how we interpret the phrase and who the judge in the back of the room or on top of the bench is, really, it's really going to vary as to where they stand on those issues. But the fact that Congress hasn't passed a formal declaration of war removes any sort of, I guess we can say, like super legal justification for eliminating our civil liberties. And I think that it's interesting to note that as we're in this war on terrorism, but at the same time, we have various other wars going on. Like we have a war on drugs, a war on poverty, things like that. And the way we define terrorists is really dangerous because the government, Drake University, the University of Texas, has decided to label some of these student protests, student organizations, like I think it's a student bar association at Drake University, in such a manner that their surveillance was now legal. Whether or not they define them as a foreign terrorist organization or whatever the nitpicking and the fine lines are, I'm not really clear about, but the fact that they've infiltrated a lot of those organizations, seized their records, makes it almost frightening that, you know, you're a college student, you know, getting out there, becoming involved, and you could instantly be tagged a terrorist or a threat to national security based upon your political positions. And with the story at Drake University, there was an anti-war march held, I think, by the Student Bar Association, and they had FBI officials show up and start asking for the records and the names of everybody involved in the march. And I think that as citizens, we need to be aware that, you know, there's some discourse that we need to have in order to have a fundamental and working democracy. While, like, you may not agree with necessarily that, you know, the war on Iraq is a good idea or whatever your political position is, but we all have this understanding that dialogue, debate, and discussion are necessary parts of our democracy. And by just rolling over and saying, all right, you know, we're at war, we're going to do this and that, we're going to curtail these civil liberties, what's the democracy we're left fighting to protect? One that we can't speak out upon, and one that we can't engage in this discussion without the government starting to ask us questions about who's showing up, who are these people, where's the money coming from, things like that. Anyone else?
I would just like to make a point on that subject. You know, we saw, you know, most of us didn't see firsthand, student protests in the Vietnam era. And I would say a lot of our parents probably may have been involved in that. And, you know, okay, we can write letters to our Congress critters, that's nice, but we can, each of us can, you know, talk to 10 friends, you know, how it goes. I think if we were to point out to our own parents and to people, you know, and I don't know the voting demographics, I think people that are older are more likely to vote, they're less apathetic. Talk to these people who understand, you know, the power of a protest and say, look, you know, the legislation as it sits would have shut you down during your Vietnam protest, and we would still be in that war. I think that would be a really powerful angle we should pursue.
Anybody?
So how are they using the Patriot Act and the guise of, okay, this is supposed to help prevent or combat terrorism, you know, right, to go after the online gambling, using PayPal to sell stolen goods, pornography on the internet? How are they working it to go after...
Because I started off talking about how financial institutions and those things have all been redefined under the Patriot Act. So they're expanding definitions of things like financial institutions, businesses, and just various people who are handling money in order to bring them under this blanket legislation. That as soon as we begin to change the way we understand the words within the legislation, we can expand or contract its scope. Like if financial institution only means securities trading firms and large multinational banks, then, you know, really, like, eh. But if we're sitting around and we're defining the pawn shop on the corner over there as a financial institution, well, when you go to get that loan, they're gonna run a background check. They're gonna start wondering where the money's coming from, where these goods are coming from, things like that. Like Western Union, like I said, fined $8 million. PayPal has been fined a bunch of money too because they didn't have anti-money laundering compliance. They didn't have a bunch of the red tape that basically what made that model so simple for PayPal. It's like, here's the money, we'll transfer it, we'll make the auction go really quickly. But they didn't have that because they were looking for simplicity and a functional business model. And I guess that's what's scary is that, you know, in America we're like, we want lean, efficient businesses. We want everybody to work as efficiently as possible. We have this whole like Protestant work ethic or whatever you want to call it. But the government, by imposing these sort of regulations, it tends to work against itself and work against a lot of the ideals that we've established. And what's interesting from the ACLU's perspective is that, you know, traditionally, like big business and things like that, you know, they don't want us to come and give, you know, talk to them. They could really care less. But we've seen a lot of requests from like Lions Clubs, small business organizations, because they're wondering, you know, if I'm not sure what's going on, what's my liability here? And I think we all have a lot of liability that we're not really aware of in one way or another.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have to wrap this up. Yeah, we're going to wrap this up now. We encourage you to move up to the impromptu room upstairs on the floor to continue this discussion. This has been a great discussion.
Here.
Thank you.
Thanks.